He is Paul Reese. I am John Dragunas, and you are listening to Double Underscore. Hey, Paul, how are you doing today?
Doing good, John. It's good to be back recording another episode, and I have something on my mind that I can't wait to get off my chest. I hope you're ready for this one.
I hope it's about your March Madness bracket.
It is not about March Madness, but that is on my mind for a different podcast that I'm not part of. I'm going to avoid the temptation to talk about... Actually, I'm doing pretty good with my bracket.
I'm in the 99th percentile right now.
But don't distract me, John, because...
Sorry, I had to go there.
I know you did. But I want to talk about this flow issue. We always like to kick off these episodes with something we learned. So I want to see if you've ever come across this. Here's what I learned literally just today. I have a screen flow where a user selects a row. It's similar to something I mentioned earlier, but a different flow and different use case. But you basically select one or more records from a table, and then there are separate input fields that you want to basically make updates to multiple records. Well, sometimes if the updates that you're trying to make are not going to pass validation, like a validation rule on the object, we want to catch that in the flow and not wait for the validation rule. So if we need to present an error, it looks pretty instead of the typical ugly standard flow errors. So I built all that in, but what's happening is within the loop of the selected records, if the validation doesn't pass, then it just bails out of that current iteration of the loop and goes back to the screen before, forces the user to correct their data, and then proceeds to go to the loop again. Well, what I found when testing that was the second time going through the loop, when I was debugging, it just said start loop, end loop. Like, it didn't do anything. It was acting as if it had already finished the loop and there was nothing left to go through, so it just skipped it. Have you seen this?
I haven't, so I'm curious. I do want to ask a clarifying question. When you bailed on the loop, was it on the last iteration or like the last record you were looping through, or was it like partially through?
Both ways. It was definitely not through. So whether I selected one or two records, it behaved the same way. Whether it was the first or the second where the validation was an issue.
I was curious if maybe it would like pick up, you know, part of the way through the collection you were looping on or something like that.
No, it's just, so within the loop, there's just a redirect, like a decision within the loop. And it's like, if it doesn't pass validation, then take the user out of this loop completely, back to the screen before it, and then through the loop again. And it just
ignored
the loop the second time.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I don't think I have. That's an interesting issue. Is it something that you found Salesforce validated or no?
Well, I did what I always do, which is I go straight to Google and started looking for it was kind of strange. Like, I had to search a few different ways because the things that were coming up were not what I was looking for. And I ultimately found other people had come across this, and the answer was so simple but not obvious, which is this: let the loop finish before you do your validation and redirect to a different place within the flow. There's something about starting a flow iteration and not, sorry, a loop iteration and not finishing it that creates the problem. But what I did is I still had all the same validation, all the same like decisions within the loop, but I didn't act on them until outside the entire loop. And then I said, hey, if you flagged any of these validation things, now go back to the screen. And if you do that, then it goes through the loop as if it's the first time again.
Interesting. So
the moral is just don't exit a loop if you're in it. Let the loop finish and then go where you want to go. And then it's fine.
Yeah, especially if you intend to come back to it, it sounds like. So
right.
This is definitely one of those scenarios. I'll be honest, right? I'm not a developer. I do a lot with flow, and I think I've gained a better basis for development because of it. But I'm curious if this is one of those areas where my knowledge gap ends that could be technically explained or not.
Yeah, I don't know. I did get pretty nervous initially because I thought, wait, this is just how Flow works. I don't know that I'm going to come up with a workaround.
Like, sure.
There's no setting anywhere. There's no attribute. There's like, you know, we are doing developer-like things with Flow, but with a lot less flexibility and capability because we're limited by what the tool offers us.
Yeah. And yeah, that's the most challenging part about Flow, right? Is you can only customize as far as really Salesforce will let you, unless, again, you start getting into adding Apex into the flow and stuff like that. But within their core set of actions, you're semi-restricted and limited.
And I do appreciate, like, Salesforce has done a good job with giving you warnings or even errors, like, hey, this flow won't run and you can't activate it until you fix these things.
Right.
Or it'll have like, hey, be careful. You're doing a lookup on the object that you started. Are you sure you need to do that? And like, those are great warnings. And
yeah,
I think this would be another great one. Hey, it looks like you rerouted the flow inside of a loop. Maybe don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That would be a good one.
Yeah.
That would be a good one. Well, I've got something I learned this week too. And mine's probably, I don't know, on the beginner spectrum of flow, although I just came across it and I don't know that I would. You know, I've been working in the flow space for a while, so I'm kind of surprised I have not run into this before. But specifically to do with using the email core action in flows. So use it pretty regularly, right? You could think of some use cases. Project got created. Oh, I want to email user A, B, and C. Or project is nearing close. I want to notify all of the people assigned to this project that the project is being closed and that you'll no longer be able to enter time, right? Like, that's the purpose of this email core action. The way that it works is you could just pull it into a flow element. You can build out a subject, an email, a recipient list, and all that kind of thing, right? Well, I learned today, unfortunately, in testing it with a user, that it's got a limit. You can only send it to 5 people at a time. So kind of an unfortunate limitation. Not sure if you've ran into that before or not. I've got a workaround.
I have.
But you have. Okay.
Yeah, I'm curious what workaround you came up with, because I ran into this last year. What'd you come up with?
Yeah, so I did learn, I will say off the record, there's a, or not off the record, on the record, I don't know, whatever. There is a plugin from Salesforce, on official Salesforce, called Better Flow Email Action or something like that. I can't think of the name offhand. Could easily follow up with it, but that does allow you to break this limit, so you can go well past it. But I thought of a limit within the system that I think could work pretty well. There's kind of 2 ways I think it could go about it. So in my case, right, it was a soft closure email alert on a project that needed to go out. So a project was nearing close and they wanted to email all the resources on that project. Hey, project is going to close in 48 hours. You need to get your time entered in that amount of time. Otherwise, you know, you're going to have to reach out and it's going to be a much bigger process and all that kind of stuff. So my thought is the way I needed to do that was to iterate and loop on the assignments on the project. And rather than sending the email to one big distro list from the project, I could actually launch another flow, either from a field update to the assignment or some sort of subflow that would actually initiate that email sending from the assignment itself. Now, in this customer's use case, they had a few other people that needed to be notified, including like the regional manager of the project and the practice manager. But that's not too difficult, right? Now they are only down to 1 to 3 emails. And so you could send the email to those people from the project, and then you could send the rest out to the people actually assigned to the project by triggering a flow from the assignment record instead.
So in your case, you had records that were that you could trigger a separate record triggered flow so that an email would be sent from each record.
That's right. So that does obviously assume, yeah, you've got related records that you could pull contact info from. Now, I guess I'll kind of state, right? I mean, if you're sending emails to some people in the system, right, there's usually a way to collect and iterate on those. So I think I would still probably lean that way. If you're sending external, obviously you're going to run into a different set of issues.
Right. Yeah. And mine was, when I first ran across this, it was similar, where basically there was a requirement that if somebody is overbooked, overscheduled, overallocated, whatever you call it. You've scheduled somebody to work more hours than they have available in a week. The flow went through, every time you change somebody's schedule, it would go through week by week for, I think, 13 weeks into the future, just so I could limit the number of iterations and how many assignments. But basically, the requirement was, if the person is overbooked for any week, find, like, collect the project managers of all of those projects that the person is scheduled to for that week, and email all the PMs and say, hey, this resource is overbooked, starting whatever the week is, and you're a PM on one of their projects, so be aware. It's really just notification. Somebody's overbooked.
Right.
And the problem there is that the PMs would pile up, even though, you know, in retrospect, I like your idea that I could have, like, triggered all those individual assignments to send an email. I think that probably could have worked, but at the time, it was like sort of an add-on requirement, right? Late in the build phase of the project, and we were running out of time and budget, and scope creep was a problem, right? So what I did is, when I ran into that limit, I just said, okay, we're limited to five. So I'm going to have the flow do just a little decision that counts how many emails have we collected so far. If we're not at five yet, go ahead and add one to the collection. If we are at five already, then whoever that is just going to be left off. Right. So either way, it's going to notify five individual people, but if seven should have been notified, that's just too bad. So not really a solution, but a way to prevent the flow from failing, at least.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. At least prevents a failure. Yeah. It's tough, 'cause I mean, you could get into something like distro groups and all that kind of stuff, but again, that assumes it's a fixed group of people every time, right? So if you're dynamically sending, you're kind of stuck to somehow capturing and getting that data on platform and then breaking it out. There's probably another way. I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it beyond that, just because it works for my use case. But yeah, there's got to be some other ways you could get around it too, I think. Yours included.
Yeah, so, that's interesting.
Yeah. So anyways, I felt a little silly for learning that on a customer call, but... I learned it on a customer call, and at least I had an answer pretty quick. So,
yeah. But when is really a perfect time to learn something? Usually there's somebody else involved and some amount of embarrassment. I just hope to limit it.
Yeah. My preference is just to learn it in my own test, you know?
That's true. I've got something that I really want to talk to you about. I was remembering something that happened to me early in my career, and I want to run this by you. I don't think this is a story. Maybe I've told you at some point, but I think there's some interesting lessons that can be learned from this. So for anybody listening in, if you are early in your consulting career, or even if you're not consulting, but you're interested and you're early in your career and you haven't faced a lot of challenging scenarios, here's one that I faced on one of my earliest projects in my first year of consulting. It was probably my first couple of months of consulting at all ever. So I was in a room with a customer. There was a typical conference table, people sitting around the table, roughly, I don't know, 8 or 10 people from the customer and 2 from my company. So I was with a colleague who was leading this discussion. It was a requirements workshop for 2 days. And the reason I was there is because my colleague had implemented this company's UK division, and I was going to be leading their US division, which was different, but there was a lot of overlapping requirements. And so I was really there to learn, but also, you know, what they did for UK, and then also so that I would be prepared to take over. So about halfway throughout, maybe 2 hours into the first day, in the middle of the discussion, nothing prompted this. Somebody actually physically stood up from the customer site and said, "Hold on just a minute. I just want to take a pause here." And he pointed to my colleague, who was talking a lot, and he said, "I know you and why you're here, but I don't know who you are and why you're here." And then he pointed at me. So I think he missed the intros, because we wouldn't have skipped introductions, but he must have missed that. And I was put on the spot because I hadn't said anything. And he said, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" Now,
that's awkward.
It was awkward. And I was nervous because, like, I'm the new guy at the new job doing something he'd never done before, right? So I already had like a baseline of elevated nerves. And then I've got this leader who's incidentally former Accenture, so understands consulting and was, you know, older than me, presumably much, you know, senior in his career. So he was fine with very direct confrontational communication, and I was really taken aback. So I ended up giving a good answer, and I was able to say, "Okay, I understand why you would ask that because I haven't spoken this morning, but let me explain why I'm here and why I haven't spoken yet." And I just gave him the rundown. And I said, "And the reason I'm here is because I know this software inside and out, and I'm the right person to lead this part of the implementation for you." And then it was fine. He was like, "Oh, okay." And he sat down and we went on. But it really made me think, partly because I was not really traumatized, but certainly wanted to talk about it over dinner with my colleague. Like, does that happen all the time? How common is that? Should I be ready for that? And he was like, "No, that was just one person. It hardly ever happens. I've never seen it happen." But here's why.
I'm impressed that you came up with that answer on the spot, by the way. Props for that. So anyways, keep going.
Yeah, I have a reason for that. We might get to it at some point. But to me, the thing that struck me about that was it was a really good question. And it was partly my fault for, maybe fault is the wrong word, but I take some responsibility for him feeling like he needed to ask that question. Because I was in the room, I wasn't talking. And that's an obvious question. What are the people who are in the room who aren't talking? What are they doing here?
Especially from the vendor, right? The services provider. Yeah, no, I agree with that. Yep.
Even if he had skipped the intros, right? There's still an expectation that if you're not leading, you're still participating. I always used to notice how much, like, I would watch TV shows. Like, you pull up any typical, like, police show, and you got two cops, and they're interrogating somebody. 10 times out of 10, the cops will share the dialogue almost equally. Like, one person will ask a question, the other one will follow up, the other one, like, there's this balance, like, well, there's two cops, they're both talking, that makes sense.
Right.
And I noticed really early on, like, I would sit in on calls, and it's, consulting is not like that. There's one person doing all the talking, and like 80% of the people listening, not saying anything, maybe multitasking.
Yeah. Yeah. That's gotten worse, by the way, in the digital world of consulting, I think.
It has. The more we work remotely, the more people are working distracted, I think.
Yep.
So, anyways, the reason I wanted to bring this up and bounce it off of you is, what do you think of the idea? This is a two-part question. What do you think of the idea that it is our responsibility to not have customers feel like they have that question, to like make our value obvious? To talk, if we're on a call, there's a reason we're on a call, and it's usually not to just listen. How do we do all of that? And then, kind of more importantly, do we have an answer ready? If you are ever asked that question, are you able to pull out an answer that's cohesive and that makes sense and doesn't reveal some kind of inner terror at being put on the spot?
Yeah.
So let's start with the first one, John. What do you think? Is it our job to make sure the customer doesn't wonder why we're there?
Yeah, absolutely. I really don't like being on calls that I'm not leading, unless I'm like mentoring or shadowing, mentoring somebody really at this point more so, or shadowing somebody in some cases. Just because it's hard to know how to participate in a way that provides value still. Now, I still do it, right? I'm on calls like that sometimes, and probably more actually the longer I consult. But I've always like had this like hard time with it. And it's specifically because of the fact that like, if I'm on a call, I want to be talking and providing insight to the discussion, not because I just want to talk, but because I think intrinsically, I'm like, I want to prove my value to this customer, right? They're paying for my time. They want me there. I better show them why I'm there, you know, that type of thing. I definitely think it's our responsibility. Now, I think that looks different in certain cases. I think sometimes, you know, you are going to introduce yourself on a call and who you are and all those types of things. And you're not going to introduce yourself to the customer every single time you're on a call with them. And sometimes it makes sense to kind of be in the background listening for when something gets directed your way or all those types of things. But if I'm going to be on a call and I'm going to be billing time, I would like that customer to walk away from every call with, oh yeah, no, I get why John was on that call. I don't want them to be asking the question, well, why were you on that call? Right. I've been on calls, with project managers before where the customer's been like, well, I don't think we need a project manager for this part of the call, so they can leave. You know, the customer basically saying, hey, we don't want to build for this time or that type of deal. And luckily I've had some really good project managers that are like, well, actually, this is probably why you want me on this call at this point in time, because I'm going to do a great job of tracking the risks or doing these things to ensure that what's discussed is, you know, acted upon, that type of thing. And so I think it is important to be able to prove yourself to a customer and really have their buy-in on why you exist on the project. Probably more the project than the call, though, if that makes sense.
Well, I think both scenarios are true. I mean, I've certainly worked with project managers who sit on calls and listen in and wait for somebody to call out an explicit action item or risk,
right,
or something.
Right.
It's like, hey, is there a PM on here? Okay, good. Will you do this small task for me that I thought of that you should have thought of?
Yeah. Yeah. That's not great, obviously.
That's not great, but it's, you know, everybody has to start somewhere. You don't always get to work with 20 years experienced PMs, right? And sometimes people need a little bit of help. Like, hey, this would be a good opportunity for you as a PM to take detailed notes on the call and to listen for action items. And then after the call, compile your notes and send them out to the participants. Like, that's how you show your value.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
among other exactly. ways, but absent that, I mean, I've wondered myself why a PM is on a call if, you know, depending on the call and the PM.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I've done the same thing. Right. But I mean, I think back to the point and what you were asking of me is I do think it is our responsibility. And I think you can be on a call for one of three reasons. One, you have technical expertise, right? Like technical and domain expertise. Two, you have subject matter expertise. Or three, you're going to be, again, like I'd call that almost more the PM category, like assessing and understanding potential risks that other people are maybe missing, making sure those things are documented, all that type of stuff, action items, those types of things. But like, from a services delivery perspective, like those are three reasons you would be on a call, unless, again, you're maybe mentoring a new consultant or shadowing a more experienced consultant or something like that. And so if you can't kind of justify one of those three reasons, you might even be asking yourself why you're on the call.
Yeah, you might, or you might be asking one of your colleagues, who is the person dominating the discussion, why you're on the call. Am I needed on this call, or should I just wait till after the call and collect the notes?
Right. Right. So, I guess, you know, I'll add to that. There are cases where it makes sense for, you know, someone to be on call hearing requirements firsthand if they're going to build it, right? It can maybe streamline that communication gap a little bit. So I shouldn't maybe make it strictly those three categories, but those are the three reasons I can like generally think of in a consulting space.
Yeah. And I think there's things that we can do to, let's say if I'm on a call and I know I'm going to be leading the discussion, but I've got say two colleagues who are listening in because it's important that they hear all of the back and forth and the, oh, we think this, but you bring up a good point. Like all of that is important to understand later in the project if we're, say, going through requirements. So for them to listen in on that is valuable. But I will say I've learned due to some, you know, I had feedback from an employee long ago who said, Paul, it's really hard to feel like part of a team when you keep answering all of the customer's questions, starting with I, like I think and I will and I know. And it was great feedback for this employee to tell me, can you please try to work on phrasing things as we, so that we feel more like we're on your team and not just following you. And So I try to be conscious of that. I'm not perfect at it, but I also try to say, I try to think, okay, if I'm sort of leading, but somebody is here for partly a learning opportunity, but also they belong in the project, try to look for opportunities to include that person and say, hey, Elaine, I think this is right, but I know you've worked on this a lot too. Is there anything that I should be adding to that? Just kind of check in with him and show that, hey, it's not just a one person show. You know, it is all of us working together. Sometimes just a couple of those nods to people like, does that sound right? Anything to add to that? Did I miss anything? Those kinds of inclusive little statements go a long way. So the customer sees, okay, they're checking together as a team. That's why they're here.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's a really good point. I don't think of that maybe as often with new people on the call, and I probably should. I'm better at it with if I bring in someone more experienced, right? Like there's been times I've tapped on you to come in and support me on a really weird revenue recognition conversation or something like that. And when I do that, I don't necessarily want the customer to think like, oh yeah, I brought Paul in to lead this because I can't, but I'll direct questions at you, right? I'll kind of give you your opportunity to say, hey, this is where I need you. You got this one? You know, that type of thing.
Oh, I love that. When a consultant, I want the consultant, whoever it is, if I'm being pulled in as a solution architect for like, hey, we're in a weird kind of unique situation. We want to pull you in and get your take on it. That's great. But I love it when the consultant owns the relationship. They still own the project. They still,
right. You
know, they kick off the call. They set the agenda. They say, here's where we were. Here's where we got stuck. Let's just rearticulate this for Paul or John or whoever we're bringing in. Make sure right. They understand. And then only where they need me, then they hand it over and say, okay, Paul, what do you think about that?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something I kind of learned early on. And I think I actually learned it because, you know, when I was younger in my consulting career, I'd ask you to support me on a call. And then we'd get on there and be like, all right, Paul, you got this. And you'd be like, nope, I think you do.
Yep.
They're like, oh crap. Okay. Well, here we go. But yeah, no, I mean, I think that's the right way to do it, right? Let the consultant own the conversation and then pass the conversation off when it makes sense. It really builds credibility and validity for both people then.
Yeah, it really does. And I was a little bit slow to learn this lesson. I do think I'm a lot better now, but the more you include your team, the less like it's better for you. If you're purely a selfish person, let's say you're a sociopath.
Yeah.
And you're listening to this podcast and you're like, how can I act human enough to get through this particular challenge? Well, it might not seem strictly selfish to include your team in like ensuring the people are owning the part that they need to own and that they're participating. But it actually, in the long run, the more the customer relies on the collective team and not one person they perceive as the most senior or the most experienced, then the better off the team is because it's less pressure, right? You don't have to be on every call if you're that senior person. You can
right. Just
have the team come to you when they need to. So right. It actually does. It's better for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that kind of transitions nicely into something that I was thinking about lately, and it's customers that are challenging at giving requirements and the reason challenging in like answering requirements types questions. The reason I think it's relevant is like if a consultant pulls in an architect for a topic that they're not super familiar with and just hands off the conversation to them, well, then that consultant is losing credibility in the customer eyes.
Yeah, that's right. I've got a call scheduled later this week, that is that very scenario. I'm being pulled in to back somebody up to lead a discussion. And those can be tricky. So yeah. tell me more. Like you're saying difficult customers, I was about to say that's way too broad. And then you said with requirements gathering, which is narrowing it down a bit. I wonder if we can narrow it down a little bit further. What do you mean?
Yeah.
Why would a customer be difficult with requirements gathering?
Yeah, I should have explained it a little bit more. But I mean, like early on in a project, right? It happens throughout a project, but you're gathering requirements. And every once in a while, I feel like you work with a customer who's just resistant to giving good requirements, right? They don't want to answer your questions. They answer them vaguely. They kind of skirt past them, that kind of thing. And I'm not talking about requirements, customers that are just like kind of struggle to communicate them, but more so customers that just like, I don't know, almost like evade the requirement, you know, like they're borderline hostile at times almost.
So I want to give some examples of this, because you saying that made me think of one example, but you've probably got others. Like, I had a customer one time, just immediately comes to mind when you said this, where when I would ask a clarifying question, the answer was visible frustration and some kind of question that would deflect, like, don't you guys do this all the time? And it was like, well, yeah, of course, but the way we do it for you specifically, we need a little bit more information. It's like, well, I just told you, right? So it would be like any attempt to get a little bit more was met with this sort of exasperated, we've already gone over this. I don't understand why it's so complicated.
Yeah, I find that comes from the customer who thinks their requirement is industry standard, and sometimes it's not, right? Like, that's one of the reasons I see this. I'm thinking of this example that I had from early on in my consulting career, actually. I've got a few, and maybe we'll talk about them, but I'm going to share this one because I think this is insightful. This first customer that I'm thinking of that I struggled to get requirements from, I found was really rooted in the fact that, like, they were just a visual group, right? And so I was going through, like, these formal requirements gatherings, asking them questions, trying to kind of, like, pull their process out, right? This is a full implementation, PSA and ERP, and a fairly unique build. And I just wasn't getting good answers. We were gathering requirements in silos. So we were gathering PSA requirements, we were gathering ERP requirements, and, like, we weren't really ever pulling the team together to talk about the end-to-end solution. And I think that's part of where we failed. But, like, the other piece of it was I just found that, like, they needed to, like, visually see what we heard them telling us. And so I found, like, the tipping point for this customer to be, we took everything we had heard so far, right? We had already been talking to them for, like, man, way too long at this point. I don't even know how long it had been, but too long. And put together, like, this really large end-to-end process map of, from the time a project was ever even initiated, actually from the time they started planning projects to the time that they actually executed on that project, delivered on that project, and, like, completed it out all the way through the accounting process, right?
And so you can imagine full life cycle process diagram.
Full life cycle. Yeah. I'd say quote to cash, but, like, that wasn't really the case for this particular customer. It was a little bit unique. And so we put together this full life cycle diagram of their business process. And I think we literally had, man, I don't know, probably like a couple 2 to 3 hour calls walking through it with them and just really making sure we understood it. And what we found was that we did understand a lot of it, but there was also some major gaps that we needed to kind of cover and fill in. And that ended up becoming the requirements document in that case, right? Like, it didn't have to be this complex, like, table of requirements or design document, because for them, it was really this visual that brought it all together for them. We, of course, put that to a design and kind of talked about how this would actually technically work as a build. But, like, being the customer that they were, this visual was just extremely helpful in actually getting us to the point where we could start building a system that worked for them.
This was a customer that I was helping with, right? 2-3 years ago?
Yeah, like, I think you're probably, yeah. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I remember one of the struggles being the idea of a budget, right? I think they were using the word budget several times. Like, well, first we have a budget and then we need the, and it was like, I remember being confused. Where is the budget? Where does it live? And it turned out it was, like, multiple places. And figuring out at what level they budgeted was really difficult, like, verbally. And the visual just seemed like, oh, it all fits together now that we can see it.
Right. One, I think, like, we immediately translate to technical terms within the system, right? And it's like, it wasn't this concept of a project budget, right? It was really like a organizational budget. And so just thinking about how you would help someone do planning in that context was unique to PSA. And so I do think there's an aspect of they struggled to communicate requirements. We struggled to hear them because we were maybe too tied to our terminology in that case.
Right.
So in that case, I think a visual created a common language.
So in your example, that customer was trying to participate. They were trying to give requirements, right? They weren't resistant.
That's fair. That's fair. I did say resistant. This customer was not resistant. They just struggled to give requirements that made sense to us. And again, you could put blame on both sides, but that was a bigger struggle for them than maybe other customers.
Yeah, I guess more broadly, you could say there is friction that comes from different sources whenever you're gathering requirements. And, you know, one of those can be a customer who seemingly has an attitude where they're against either this exercise or the project in general, or maybe you in particular.
Right. But
like sometimes there is legitimate resistance, and other times it's like, no, all sides are trying really hard, but there's terminology differences, there's cultural differences, there's all kinds of reasons why you can just miss each other when you're trying.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've got an example of a, if you want to hear another one of a kind of more friction in requirements and
yeah, I think those are harder to figure out.
So
yeah, when you've got a customer who seems like against what you're trying to do, it's really baffling.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had one, pretty big customer and pretty extensive requirements process that I went through with this customer. And I got to a particular part in the requirements where I was truly just met with, oh, well, why don't you know this already? Like, this is kind of similar to yours, right? Like, this is industry standard. This is how everyone does it. And couldn't really find a solution to changing things, right? I tried a couple things with them. So I want to talk about what I tried first, and then I want to talk about what I think the tipping point was, along with a couple other things. So I tried visuals, right? I've learned in some cases that works, like the example I just talked about. I also tried breaking it down to more of like actually building a visual together. So rather than coming to the call with a visual, like, hey, let's build one together. Yep. I tried asking to see how it worked in their current system. Like, hey, can you show me what you're trying to do here? In this particular case, it was like really focused around project financials. And so like, hey, can you show me what you're trying to get this data in your PSA system to look like in your ERP system? Like, can you walk me through a mapping? Like, how do you want your costs to translate to your ERP system? How do you want your billings to translate to your ERP system, et cetera, right? And couldn't really get clear answers on mappings, which I know some people are gonna be like, what? You couldn't get clear answers there? But, you know, for whatever reason, right? I couldn't get clarity. And then I also tried bringing some other people into the call just to see if I could have different questions, different perspective, and that on kind of the call that I was on. And again, still kind of met with a little bit of challenge there. So I found in this particular case that there was two things that kind of translated to a tipping point. The first one was realizing that the customer I was working with really thought that PSA was a project accounting system, and it's not. It's not a project accounting system, right? There's systems out there that do just that. And so kind of helping clear that air that we're not in that position. And then the second thing that I feel like led to a tipping point was kind of realizing, hey, I don't know that in a formal requirements call, we're going to get past where we are today. I think by the end of the hours of conversations on the topic, we had a base idea of what was needed and a big question mark over what the effort was going to be. And this person wasn't so much visual as they were wanted to actually click and feel the system a little bit, right? And so I think there was a little bit of, and this is scary, but let's put a bigger effort estimate on this than we think it's going to take and know that we're going to have to iterate through this probably 3, 4, 5, 6 times in the build. With the team to make sure we've got it right. And so there was actually an aspect and a point where we were like, okay, we're done. We've gathered the requirements we can gather at this point. We're going to put a little bit of an unknown question mark over this, and we're going to have to flesh this out in an iterative build cycle. And interestingly enough, in that particular case, although this customer was resistant during some of these requirements calls, ended up being a pretty big champion for the project and really helped keep things pretty in scope and out of the box, which is interesting because this particular piece that we're talking through with the project accounting would have been really quite a custom solution for them.
Okay, so this was a case where they were assuming, I think you said, that what they were asking for was standard or normal.
That's, That's right.
Okay. Yep. But your perception was, no, this is really not what our product or this particular product was designed to support. So maybe we can, but you have to explain it better. And that was kind of, it was difficult to explain in like the same language. That
pretty. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think you're spot on.
But you're saying moving it to say, all right, this is as far as we're going to get with actual written requirements. Let's just try working through it together. That got over the friction of misunderstanding and you were able to work collaboratively with them on like, I built this much. How close is it? How did it end up working?
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't fully involved in the build cycle, which is ironic. In this particular example, I handed a lot of it off, but it actually ended up working really well. We found out that what they were asking for in a lot of respects was actually much simpler than what they were communicating on requirements. And so we were struggling to place requirements because they were asking in a way that was just foreign to the concept of like a PSA system. But as we started building it, right, as we actually started mapping out like PSA transactions, like the cost transactions, the billing transactions, all that stuff, based on how they wanted it within their kind of business hierarchies, right, within like the regional hierarchies, their business unit or what we would call practice hierarchies and things like that, it was actually fairly simple to put essentially formulas on transaction records that gave them essentially, you know, costing reports that they needed for their ERP solution.
I want to go back to something you said that struck me. You said that Certinia PSA is not a project accounting solution. And yet we have so many, like the product has so many like accounting related values on the project. So what do you mean by that?
Oh man, you're going to put me on the spot here. So I mean, I think the way that I look at that, right, is there's kind of a couple ways to run PS, right? And you get into managing your project and your financials. And what I think I typically try to explain that to people as is like, we run project costs, we can calculate project margin, things like that. But what we don't typically get into without a lot of customization is like, we're not actually doing necessarily like intra-company and writing project transactions to like a specific GL and different things like that. And so we are more like broad, like, hey, we can give you a frame of reference for your project margin, but we're not typically going to get into tracking burden costs on a project and different things like that.
Well, here's one way, because this comes up quite a bit with me too, of like, is PSA an accounting solution? Obviously not. It's not accounting. That's why it has a different name than accounting. But
right,
like it does have a lot of really rich project accounting features. The way I think about this, absolutely, especially when I'm talking to accounting people, is PSA's project accounting, you can think of as basically single entry accounting, not double entry. So no debits and credits, just
right,
credits.
Yep.
So in terms of how the data is stored, it's not double entry, but it does have all of the like cost and revenue and plans and actuals and all of those things. And it stores them in a fairly sophisticated way. It's just that if you want to take that data and translate it to accounting data with double entry, that's where we say it's not like a true, the data isn't stored with debits and credits.
Yeah, that's probably the easiest way to explain it.
Yeah. Yeah. The only reason I bring that up is I've been in some discussions around, okay, what is it really? If you're telling me it does project accounting, but it's not an accounting system, I've just had a number of customers really want to understand what we mean by that. So
yeah, no, that's a good way. I mean, I'll probably steal that from you in the future. I tend to think about the things we don't, but it's easier to simplify that down to we don't do debits and credits.
Yeah, it's less like what we're tracking, like what data is there. It's more about how it's stored and is it auditable in the same way of a double entry. Yeah.
That's fair.
Okay. So in your two examples so far of what I'm going to call this episode, permission to treat the witness as hostile, when we have customers who are actually behaving as if they are hostile.
Yeah.
You covered two semi, like one was just challenging because the customer had a hard time like communicating it. They knew it, but they didn't. It's like, explain what air is. Well, like, you live with air every day, but how often do you have to really explain it? Sometimes that's hard for customers to just understand their business well enough to communicate it to an outsider in a way that makes sense. Like, that's just hard.
Yeah.
And then absolutely. You had the thing that's just unusual and unique to a business that you had to work through iteratively. That's fine. But I'm really interested in when customers legitimately seem hostile. Have you come across this? Because I know I sure have.
I have. It's not often. I don't want to scare people away from consulting if they're considering. It does not happen often. But absolutely, I have been in situations, and I'm trying to think of one offhand, where I'm just met with like a, I don't want to answer that question, or you should already know this, or, you know, why are you asking me this kind of thing? And I'm okay with people that are difficult to win over, but I will admit it's tough for me when it's like actually like borderline hostile in the way that they ask the question.
Yeah, it is tough because what I want to do is like after that call, let's say the call ends early because it's just like, this is a waste of time. We need to regroup and think about what we're going to do with this whole project. That's happened to me a couple times. I want to reach out to that person one-on-one and be like, hey, can we just talk about this? Like, what are you concerned about? But that's the very person that is not going to have that conversation with you.
Yeah.
If they're already so frustrated with the exercise or something about it, it's hard to get to them and say, what's really going on under the surface?
It is. And who knows if it's personal conflict at that point, either with you or something going on in their life. I mean, there's so many things, right? I try to not let myself be jaded by it, but still usually want to figure out the answer for it too.
Right. Right. Do you have anything that you've learned, any tips or tricks, or is it just one of those unfortunate parts of the job that there doesn't seem to be an answer to?
You know, I actually am. I just thought of this one, actually. I forgot about this. So I will say I don't know that this would work in every situation. And I'll also say I killed myself making this one work. So preface with, I don't know if this is a good solution, but it did work. I had a customer, one of the very first calls, got on the call, did a end-to-end demo for them. And they were like, hey, that doesn't look like what we saw in the sales process. And I was like, uh-oh. Run the other way, right? No. And basically what happened is there's an early part of the demo that I did, and it sounds like what was demoed to them in the sales process was slightly different, where, you know, milestones were going to be automatically created from the project, and that's what they were expecting to see. So I was like, okay, I thought about it a little bit. I was like, we've got a solution for that. It is kind of out of the box. It doesn't work for most people, and I showed it to them. They're like, that's not going to work for us. That's not what we saw in the sales process. And it turned into kind of a big escalation on the project of, hey, sales sold us something different. You're not delivering on X requirement. And there was probably a month on the project where they were just really frustrated with me, even though it wasn't really my fault or anything like that. Auto project creation wasn't in scope. I showed them how milestones could be automatically created from an opportunity and things like that, using some out of the box functionality without any customization. And it didn't meet their need, and they weren't happy about it. So all that to say, I think for the first 3-4 weeks of the project, there was a decent amount of hostility. I kind of felt like I was walking on eggshells. I kind of felt like anything I said might get escalated. Anything I didn't say might get escalated. Right. And with that particular customer, I just worked my tail off. I worked till 1 a.m. some nights if they were emailing me, asking me questions. I went over the top on every single thing I did as long as I could stay in budget doing it. And crazily enough, that customer is a big reference now. And I've actually gotten work from them through other sources and other companies since. So it did work in that situation. I partially think it worked because you know, I went so far over the top to make them happy. And then also they realized it wasn't really my mistake. So it was a little bit of two pieces there. So I don't know if that would work in every situation, but I have found sometimes with difficult to please people that just going over the top to like make sure that you're kind of meeting them where they're at and maybe even shifting your work style to meet them a little bit better can sometimes help, and or sympathizing with them. So like realizing like, hey, I see you feel this way. What makes you frustrated about this? Those types of things, and asking those maybe more like personable questions is sometimes successful. But every once in a while, you do just get somebody that's just hard to please.
Well, it's certainly going to work better than the alternative, which is to withdraw and do less.
Yeah, that does not work well. I would not recommend that.
No, that will fail 100% of the time.
I've maybe done that once, but
sometimes you can get lucky and find somebody else to hand it off to. And the one that I'm thinking of, it seems like my personality and approach was the exact wrong one for this customer who seemed to be going through something really difficult in their life. And it was just a perfect storm where my attempts to clarify seemed to frustrate even more the person who was already frustrated. And my attempts to push through that and dig into it just made it worse until, you know, the solution at that point, this was, I think, a couple of years ago, was Paul can't be on calls anymore. And that was, I didn't take it personally because I didn't start the fire, right? But the fire was raging and I seemed to pour fuel on it. So doing that made it worse. So people pretty much agreed, okay, no more Paul on calls. And I can take one of those every couple of years. And that's fine.
I can say, having worked with you for a few years, I've not seen that happen often. So I don't think that's a common thing.
It's not common, but you just never know, right? Like, nobody is for everybody. No matter how good your bedside manner is and how many tricky situations you've been in, there's always going to be that one combination where you're not totally in it the way you should be and they're not totally seeing it the way they should be, and it just erupts. That's what happened to me.
You know, that's what, you can't see these every time, right? But that was one of my favorite things about my first manager in the space. Like, he was particularly good about assigning people to projects that he thought would have a good personality match with the customer. And there's a lot of truth in that. I think sometimes, like, good consultants just like get along well with a lot of customers, right? Because like, if you can get along well, if like you're personable and like you can get answers, that goes a long way in the consulting space.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the more flexible you are at adapting your approach to customers.
Yeah, but also realizing sometimes your personality just isn't going to jive, you know?
Yep.
I have a very laid back personality. I do not work well with people that are really formal and stringent.
Yeah, or really hard driving and direct.
Yeah, like it's just not my style. I'm very Midwest that way.
Okay, well, the one thing that we didn't get to with this topic was actually getting permission to treat the witness as hostile. So I think one thing we've taken away is that is never a good idea. Don't treat the customer as hostile.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend that.
Maybe try killing them with kindness like you did. Work all hours of the night within budget. Maybe that'll work. Maybe it's a new person who needs to smooth things over, and maybe it's trying to get at what's under the resistance, or maybe it's what you started with, the using more visuals to bridge the communication gap. But I don't think there's one silver bullet here.
Yeah, I'll say there's been projects where sometimes there isn't an answer, and those are the ones you just grind out and you get them done. You don't work less hard. You don't give less quality, but you just get it done.
That's right. Well, John, I want to wrap up this episode with one of our lightning round episodes. So this is where, for those uninitiated, this is our fourth episode. So it's not like we've got a lot in the bank at this point. But what we do is one of us asks the other a series of questions at lightning speed, and that is Salesforce lightning speed. So you got plenty of time. And The theme of this week is astrology.
Oh boy, I'm gonna fail already.
I'm kidding. It's astronomy.
Good.
So April 8th, 2024, we are going to have first in a long time full solar eclipse. So because of that, I'm really excited, and I put some questions together for you to see how much you know about eclipses and so on. Are you ready?
Fun fact, I learned about that because my mother-in-law brought us solar eclipse glasses the other day. So we're prepared. Oh,
well, you are prepared. This should be easy for you. Why don't we start with question one, John? What is a total solar eclipse?
It is where the sun and the moon are fully aligned in orbit with the Earth.
Correct. I had to think about that answer, but yes, I was like, yeah, but which one is behind which one? And then that felt really dumb to ask that question. So
yeah,
you get full credit. Yeah. Hey, okay.
I actually feel pretty good about that.
So far, so good. Next question. What is an apogee?
Oh man.
Apogee of the moon. It relates to its orbit around the Earth.
I don't even have a guess. I feel like I should know it.
Okay, how about I'll give you a hint. It's the opposite as the perigee.
Oh. It's like it's distance. It's like furthest and closest or something, right?
Yes, the apogee is when the moon is furthest.
Oh, apogee's furthest. Okay. There you go.
Okay, when is the next total solar eclipse scheduled to hit North America?
Oh man. The last one I remember was like I was pretty young. It's like over 20 years, isn't it?
No. The next one will be 2033, so 9 years. But that will only be in Alaska.
Oh, interesting.
And then the next one that will cover Canada and some of the contiguous United States up in the north is 2044.
Hey, that was pretty close. I said 20 years.
2044. That's pretty close. I'll give you partial credit for that.
Yeah, I get like and at least an F on that question.
When a lot more states get to play again is going to be 2045. Well, John, as always, it's fun to talk about work when we're not working.
Well, take care and look forward to catching up with you next week.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
I dare you to look at the solar eclipse without glasses.
I'll post that on LinkedIn too.